We are in Matthew 24, and we are going through the sequence from Matthew 20 through Matthew 25. And I am approaching it from the perspective that this is Yeshua's final set of instructions to his disciples concerning the second coming. He has other instructions to his disciple in other parables that seem to be doing something a little bit different. This seems to be focused on the second coming. In the middle of that is, of course, Matthew 24, which is all about the signs of his second coming. So we've had a couple parables before this, and we'll have a couple of parables after this, but the centerpiece of this deal is Matthew 24. Now, the events in Matthew 24 are also in Luke 21 and Mark 13. So those three sections are parallel. They're not exactly identical, but very close. In fact, one of the differences I'll talk about when we get there tonight. From my perspective, and I will tell you where I stand before I tell you where I sit, I am not a preterist. A preterist thinks that the events of Matthew 24 happened during the Roman destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So you have various strains of preterist, but that's sort of what it revolves around, is the events in Matthew 24 happened in 70 AD. Some of them said all the events of Revelation, the same thing, and so there's no more prophecy, if you will, left to be fulfilled. We're just making disciples of all nations, and when we've made disciples of all nations, then Christ will come back and we'll present it to him. That is extreme preterism. There are shades down from that. I'm not a preterist. I'm not a rapture guy. Now, Tom, if he's out there, is a post-trib rapture guy, which I think is better than a pre-trib rapture. And for those of you who aren't up on your Christian lingo, a pre-trib rapture basically says that God is going to pull all of the baptized Christians out of here and take them up into the overhead before the Great Tribulation, and we're all going to sit up in the mezzanine and watch Satan and the Jews duke it out. That's basically what a pre-trib rapture position is. I don't agree with that. Lots of really good Bible scholars do. Lots of really good Bible scholars are preterists. So I'm not saying that these are stupid people or anything like that. I just don't see it that way. And I'll explain why as we go along. And if you see it one of the other ways, God bless you, we can still do lunch. It's nothing I am dogmatic about, it's just how I see it. The other thing that I see is in Revelation, as you all well know, there are three sequences of seven. You have seven seals, you have seven trumpets, and you have seven bowls. And in between those sequences of sevens, you've got other stuff. It is my belief that those three sequences of seven are sequential, are in order, and will happen in order. Where I think we are in Revelation is between the fourth and the sixth seal. And the reason I say that is we got wars and rumors of wars, we got famine, all that kind of stuff has been happening. So I believe he started opening seals as soon as he sat down beside his Father in heaven. The fifth seal happens entirely in heaven. That's where the martyrs are under the altar and they say, how long before you avenge our blood and so forth. That is not observable from the earth. All that happens in heaven. And then, of course, the next thing that happens is very dramatic. So I think we're somewhere between the fourth and the sixth seal, and where between, I have no idea. So that's my perspective as I'm going through this. And as I say, if you've got a different perspective, by all means, yell at me, raise your hand, and that's perfectly acceptable, and I won't throw you out of the lunch line. It's all okay. So having said that, let me start Matthew 24. Yeshua left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the building of the temple. But he answered them, you see all these things, do you not? Truly I say to you, There will not be left one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. So he's obviously predicting the events of 70 AD, because that's what the Romans do. And then verse 3, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, his disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age? So this is a private conversation between Yeshua and his disciples. In other words, there's not a crowd of Pharisees around. There's not any kind of a crowd. This is just him and his 12 disciples. Something that I find interesting about this is they certainly expect that he's the Messiah. They certainly expect that he is going to reign on earth. As you read the events in all four Gospels going up to the crucifixion, it isn't obvious that they understand what's going to happen. And so the fact that other places in the Gospel, it isn't clear that they understand that he is going to die. The question is, what will be the sign of your coming and the close of the age? Well, coming from where? You understand the question? I'm not quite sure what to do with that, quite frankly. It seems to me like a little bit of a non sequitur, but do that as seems good to you. I don't know the answer to that. And of course, the close of the age, I believe they think, is the establishment of the Messianic kingdom, and we will then have a new age, if you will, in Earth's history, with the king reigning on earth over the kingdom. Now, he has talked eternal life, basically some variation of we get to go back to the garden with the tree of life would certainly be something that they would be thinking about. So the idea of the Messianic kingdom lasting forever is not foreign to them, but I'm not sure where they think he was going, because it isn't clear to me that they understood that he was going to die. Verse 4, and Yeshua answered them, see that no one leads you astray, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nations will rise against nation, and kingdoms against kingdoms, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginnings of the birth pains. As I said at the beginning of this, where I think we are is between the fourth and the sixth seal. So all of the stuff that's going on there is stuff that we have been living with for a couple thousand years. The other thing that's interesting is he says, many will come in his name saying, I am the Messiah or the Christ. Again, that indicates he's going to leave. In other words, I'm not going to be here. So you're going to have a whole bunch of folks coming in trying to convince you that they're me. He clearly knows what's going to happen, so I don't have any problem with the way he says it. I just was kind of puzzled at the way the disciples said it. The comment was that they've had conversations where he says he's going away. They don't necessarily know that that means he's going to die, but that he's going somewhere for some period. And that's actually a very insightful comment, because one of the things that he does say in several of his parables is you have kings that go away to receive their kingdom. So I hadn't thought of that. Down to 9. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to the death, and you shall be hated by all nations for my namesake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another, and many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will increase, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. We've been 2,000 years, and we have pretty much seen all of that stuff happening. In fact, depending on whether or not he's talking about you as Christians or you as Jews, we're now seeing massive anti-Semitic uprisings throughout the United States as a result of the Gaza war. I don't know that any of them are against Christians per se, but they're definitely against Jews. And he's telling them that all of this stuff is going to happen, And don't be alarmed because the end is not yet. Now, I want to comment just for a minute two things. Because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. And what that tells you is that Torah study will go away. Because one of the things that he says, and one of the things that is in Torah, is love your neighbor as yourself. When lawlessness increases, that means that people are living and behaving contrary to Torah. That's the definition of lawlessness. And because of that, the love of many will grow cold, which is to say, if you're not walking in Torah, then you become self-focused and not outward-focused. We're seeing it in this country on steroids, where you've got people able to be stirred up in 20 minutes and have massive screaming riots over stuff that most people would think is trivial. That is a manifestation, if you will, of love grown cold. Comment was, we also have modern churches that downplay or actively discourage the Torah, and that's the first step, if you will, in the love of many growing cold. And then 14, the gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Now, every Christian radio and TV broadcaster cites this and says, we are taking the gospel to the world so that Christ will return. And by the way, that's a preterist attitude. We got to get the word out to everybody, and once everybody's got the word and all the nations have been discipled, then he'll return. I don't think it means that at all. I will take you to Revelation 14:6. This is after the seventh trumpet. Now, if you see Revelation like I do, and you don't have to, but this is how I see it, the seven seals are by way of authenticating the king. That's the deed to the place. And so as you pop seals open, it says, yep, that's him, that's him, that's him, that's him, it's his. Then you have seven trumpets which announce the coming of the king. And again, if you see it like I do, I see him touching down on Yom Teruah. And that's the only one of the biblical feasts where nobody knows the day or the hour. Because you don't know when the month starts until somebody sees the new moon, and it can be a day either way. So nobody knows the day or the hour could, I'm saying this very carefully, could refer to a Yom Teruah. No idea what year. So where we are here in this passage of Revelation 14 is we are after the announcement of the coming of the king at the seventh trumpet. So he's going to touch down, and then the king is going to start taking vengeance on his enemies, which is the seven bowls of wrath. In between, starting in verse 6, Revelation 14:6, then I saw another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on the earth, for every nation and tribe and language and people. And he said with a loud voice, fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, and the seas and springs of water. Now, back here in Matthew 24, when it says the gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world, I believe it is that event that I just read in Revelation 14. And what that is God has told us to spread the gospel throughout all the world, but he's not depending on us to get it done. You know, we're supposed to do it. We're supposed to strive mightily to spread the gospel and so forth, but it's sort of like circumcision of the heart. There's two circumcisions of the heart. Moses says, you circumcise your heart so that it'll go well with you. But at the end of the day, he says, you're not going to do a very good job. So at the end of the day, God will circumcise your heart and he'll do it right. Same thing with spreading the gospel. You guys are supposed to spread the gospel. I want to see you doing that. But at the end of the day, when the king is ready to come back, in order for him to be able to justly judge all humanity, he has to be absolutely sure that everyone has heard the gospel. And that's what that angel is doing. He's giving notice to anybody who doesn't know the gospel. You need to give glory to God. And at that point, no one has an excuse anymore. So I see Matthew 24, verse 14, as being fulfilled, if you will, in Revelation 14, 6 and 7. So you don't have to agree with this, but that's how I see it. So now we are down to Matthew 24, 15. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house. Let the one who is in the field not go back to take his cloak. And alas for women who are pregnant or for those who are nursing infants in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would have been saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. And if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So when they say to you, look, he is in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Now let's unpack that. First off, the abomination of desolation. That is in the book of Daniel. It is in Daniel 2:7, not by that name. And then Daniel 11:31 and Daniel 12:11. Those are both where he talks about that. This is a case where it has happened once before and it will happen again. The first time it happened was during the Maccabean War, when Antiochus Epiphanes set up a statue of Zeus in the temple and sacrificed a pig on the altar. His goal, if you will, was to eradicate any religion except his own within his empire. The Jews weren't playing, so he desecrated their temple. He made Torah observance illegal and kicked off the Maccabean revolt, and the Maccabeans threw the Greeks out and then cleansed the temple. That's what Hanukkah is all about. So Daniel talks about it twice, and it's going to happen this time, and it's going to happen one more. So Yeshua says, hey, remember what Daniel told you about? It's going to happen again. Now, if you're a preterist, I will go to the last sentence I just read, verse 28. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather, or there the eagles will gather, depending on your translation. I have read three different interpretations of what that means, depending on what your perspective is. If you're a preterist, and you believe that all of this happened in 70 AD, they will tell you that the abomination was Roman soldiers standing on the Temple Mount as they destroyed the temple. They will say that the eagle, who was gathering the corpse, the Roman legions had a standard, which was an eagle. So the Temple Mount is the corpse of Israel, and the eagles gather, which is the standards of the Roman Empire. If you're a preterist, that would be your explanation. If you are, I would say, a rapture guy, but not a preterist, what it would describe is a diseased spiritual condition where people are dead spiritually and vultures are gathering over them. And the passage that they use is Revelation 18. So let's go to Revelation 18 and I will read it for you. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory. And he called out with a mighty voice, Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. A vulture is definitely an unclean bird. So in that perspective on this, what we're talking about is the decayed and deprived spiritual state of worldly Babylon, which has become the haunt of every unclean bird. And so all of the unclean birds are gathered where these spiritually dead people are. That's interpretation number two. Interpretation number three, which I like, again, these are all smart people who think these things. The fact that I don't happen to agree with them doesn't mean that they're not right. These are not stupid people. The one I like is he's talking about the fact that false messiahs will try and gather his people. And they'll do signs and wonders so that if it were possible, they would lead even the elect astray. In other words, these guys are going to be convincing. And what he's saying is the Son of Man is going to come back as the lightning flashes from the east to the west. You all live in a semi-desert environment. If you're ever out on the prairie and you look around, if you see buzzards circling, you know something's dead there. And they can find it. So just as buzzards circling in a desert, which Israel is, shows where the corpse is, and it's not subtle. You can see them circling in the air, it's very obvious. Similarly, the coming of the Son of Man is going to be every bit as obvious. If you see circling vultures, you know something's dead, no doubt. Similarly, when the Son of Man comes, it is going to be every bit as obvious as buzzards circling over a dead animal. That's explanation number three. And given that he goes to great pains to tell you that unless you see the Son of Man coming in the clouds, riding in with an army in white behind him, as it says in Revelation, unless you see that, disregard, because anything short of that is not me. It's going to be obvious. It isn't going to be subtle at all. And certainly it is not going to be some guy on the radio or television or with a cult or anything like that saying, I'm the one, because he says here, no, it's not, regardless of what they say. And by the way, this is the only place the vultures are. Mark 13, it doesn't mention them. Verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and stars will fall from heaven and the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. Now remember, assuming I'm correct in my sequencing here, before the coming of the Son of Man, and after the seventh trumpet, this angel is going to tell everybody in their own language to worship God. And what he's saying here is when he comes back, then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And if you read that in Revelation, he's got an army dressed in white behind him, and he's on a white horse. Not subtle. Very dramatic and obvious. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Now, from my perspective, if you are a pre-trib rapture guy, who are those people that he's gathering? Israel? Could be. But I see that as Christians. And let me do a segue here. You've all heard me say this. One of the reasons I'm not a rapture guy is because God does things in patterns. History is prophecy. There is an entire book of the Bible that describes how God is able to take his people out of the world and then deal with the world in judgment. That's the book of Exodus. He doesn't lift his people up into the overhead. He doesn't pick them up and drop them in the desert and say, no, I'm going to go take care. He moves them up to Goshen, which is still in Egypt. He then proceeds to destroy Egypt with 10 plagues. And at that point, his people stand up and walk out. It is my opinion that the job of the 144,000 is to go throughout the world and round up God's people and get them out of the way while God deals with the world just like he dealt with Egypt. And of course, you all know that the things that happen in Revelation are pretty much identical to what happened in Exodus. Not the same order, but the same events. As I'm very fond of saying to people who believe in the rapture, if you're right, you can explain it to me on the way up. If I'm right, come to my tent in the wilderness and I'll explain it to you. But where he sends his angels to gather, I see that as being the 144,000 getting them all in one place and then him bringing them to himself as he deals with the world, which is the seven bowls of wrath. Tom says it's going to occur at the last trumpet. And as I read, the gospel going out is at the last trumpet. The last trumpet announces the coming of the king. And I'm not sure how all of that choreographs, but it's all right there. I would agree. We are now all the way down to 32. From the fig tree, learn this lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also when you see all these things, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. And heaven and earth passing away is the new heaven and the new earth with the new Jerusalem, obviously. I am of the opinion that he reigns over this earth as it is for 1,000 years. And at the end of that time, according to Revelation, Satan is once again loosed, deceives the nations, and we have the Battle of Armageddon. And then at that point is when this one gets wrapped up and we have a new heaven and a new earth with a new Jerusalem. That's how I see it. And this lesson of the fig tree, there are several places in Scripture. For example, the parable of the householder and the thief. If the householder had known what time the thief was going to come, he would never have fallen asleep and let his goods be plundered. Lots of parables having to do with being ready. And we'll read two more next time. The parable of the 10 virgins and the parable of the talents. But the idea here is you live expecting him to come back. However, he also is saying here that for his elect, his return is not going to be a surprise. Now, what do I mean? Well, he's given us the book of Revelation. And if I am right, which God only knows, I'm not dogmatic about any of this, okay? I'm not saying this saith anybody except this is what I think. If we're between the fourth and the sixth seals right now, when the sixth seal is open, it is not going to be subtle. And similarly, the seven trumpets are not going to be subtle. So I believe you're going to be able to watch the events in Revelation unfold real time, and you will then know where you are in that sequence. The question was, earlier he had cursed a fig tree, now he's using a fig tree as a metaphor for something that is going to tell you when things are going to start to unroll. It is my understanding that the cursing of the fig tree happens to be Israel. In other words, that's one of the symbols of Israel is the fig tree. So when the fig tree is not producing fruit, which it should have been, you know, he looks at the fig tree, sees leaves on it, says, okay, I'm going to go get a fig. No figs on the tree. Israel is not producing fruit. So he curses them. Here he's using it as simply a metaphor of when you see robins, you know it's springtime, even if you're up to your withers in snow. He does this several ways. You can look at the sky, and you know that it's going to be fair the next morning. In other words, you can sort of tell where you are season-wise and time-wise. Well, the fig tree is another indicator here that I have given you my word. So you know, in principle, what the sequence of events is going to be leading up to my return. And as you see those events start to unfold, the metaphor becomes, well, just like you can look at a fig tree and you can tell what season it is just by looking at the fig tree. Similarly, when you look at the events in Revelation as they begin to unfold, you'll be able to know where you are in the sequence. Now, it's entirely possible that I'm wrong and we're all going to get raptured out of here, but that doesn't make any sense to me given all the rest of this. So Matthew 24:36, but concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. And if I'm right, which I may or may not be, that would seem to indicate to me that that's Yom Teruah, which is the Feast of Trumpets. And so the idea that he is going to come back on the seventh trumpet, he's done everything else of significance on one of God's appointed times. Nothing has happened that we know of on that one. So it is my belief that the Feast of Trumpets is when he'll come down. And then 10 days later, we'll have a come to Jesus meeting. That's Yom Kippur. And then he will tabernacle with us. And as I say, the thing about Yom Teruah is you don't know when the day is until you actually see the moon. And actually seeing the moon can vary a day either way of when you expect it. If you don't like that, God bless you, we can still do lunch, but that's how I see it. Verse 37, for as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark. And they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Now, if you are an anti-rapture person, and I'm not rabid about it, the ones who are swept away, the ones who are taken, are not the ones you want to be. You want to be the ones in the boat. Okay, so now we're going to come down and read again, some are taken away and some remain. From my perspective, it's ambiguous as to what you want to be, but if you take this as your bellwether, you want to be one that remains as opposed to taken away. If you're a rapture maven, you want to be one that's taken away. Again, do that with whatever seems good to you. 40. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and one left. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. And the idea, you have these two admonitions playing off against each other. One admonition is the fig tree. You can look at the fig tree and you can tell what season it is. But you can't look at the fig tree and tell what day of the week it is. So the fig tree gives you the season, but the day and the hour, only the Father knows. Tom's perspective is he is a post-trib rapture guy. So the rapture happens after the tribulation, but before the bowls of wrath. And that's a perfectly good position to have. 45. Who then is the faithful and wise servant, whom his master has set over his household, to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. But if that wicked servant says to himself, my master is delayed, and begins to beat his fellow servants, and eats and drink with drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect, and at an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and put him with the hypocrites. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So the whole idea here is, you know the season, you can look at the fig tree and you get the season, but you got no idea when I'm going to come back. When I do come back, I want to see you doing what I told you to do when I left. And I don't want you to have slacked off, and I don't want you to be carousing and saying, well, he's not here, not going to be here in my lifetime. I might as well enjoy myself. And as we read the last two parables next week, they both have to do with what do you do between now, whenever now happens to be, and his return, and what does he expect you to be doing? So we'll talk about that next time. I got a question from Gaming out in Cyberland. Could Yom Teruah and 10 days following be the time during which the gospel is proclaimed to all the world, just in time to make a decision before the Come to Jesus meeting on Yom Kippur? Could be. The sequence of events is certainly not precise with respect to time intervals. If I am correct, and it is certainly possible that I'm not, I see those three sequences of seven in Revelation as being sequential. The rest of the stuff in Revelation is not sequential. So, short answer is I'm not sure. It seems like after the seventh trumpet, and as she says, before the Come to Jesus meeting on Yom Kippur, that may be the time when that angel flies over the whole world and proclaims the gospel to everybody. Could be. Reasonable assumption. Obviously, I don't know.